In the stories of every life are the keys to our own unique identity, the codes of our character, the shape of our souls. Here at Fusen, we have the great and good fortune to share the stories of our personal lives, to live collectively the story of our communal life, and be the inheritors of the stories of our spiritual ancestors. As I said earlier, this morning is the second in a series of sermons built around the story of our religious heritage, stories of barriers faced and overcome, stories of people, real people who stood up against the convention of their time, who at times and at great risk, physical risk, said, "Here is what matters to the very quick of me and why." This morning, we pick up our story as the foundation of our modern Unitarian Universalism here in the United States was beginning to take shape. So get your geek back on. Here we go. As one might imagine, Great Britain in the mid to late 1700s was not a very welcoming place for religious or political dissent, yet Joseph Priestley managed to do both of those very well. Raised by his Calvinist aunt, Priestley came to have a fairly heretical theological outlook, namely that God was one, eternally unique, and therefore could not be divided into three parts. Thus, he most clearly rejected the notion of the Trinity. You have to give him credit, because that didn't stop him from trying to make his way as a Presbyterian preacher. We've always been an ornery lot. He did so while doing some teaching on the side, but because preaching gigs were few and far between, he found his footing in the academy, where he excelled at teaching, scholarly writing, and scientific discovery. Priestley is credited with the invention of soda water. So next time you're having a seltzer, tip your glass to Joseph Priestley. And discovering and naming oxygen. His numerous books and publications, including A History of Electricity, that he wrote at the suggestion of Benjamin Franklin. Kind of a hard suggestion to turn down. I'll go fly a kite, you write a book about it. When the American Revolution began, Priestley sided with the colonists and, not surprisingly, promptly lost his job helping to mold the young minds in England. But shortly after that, he was called to serve a dissenting church in Birmingham. And during this time in Birmingham, he produced some of his most important theological works, and in doing so, positioned himself further and further away from the orthodoxy of his time, and thus became a larger and larger target for those threatened by his views and actions as a leader of a campaign to win full legal rights for all dissenting religious groups. And on July 14th, 1791, Priestley poked at convention one too many times when he hosted a celebration in honor of the second anniversary of Bastille Day. To support the French Revolution was akin to plotting treason. So a mob gathered and first attacked the hotel where Priestley was holding the celebration, and then moved to his house and lavatory, where both were destroyed. Most of his papers and books were thrown into the street and burned right there. Somehow, though, he and his family managed to escape and fled London, where his reputation, not as a scholar, not as a renowned scientist, not as a beloved teacher, but rather as a radical, followed him. 3 years after the riots, unable to make a proper living, he and his family emigrated to America. He began a new life in Pennsylvania, where he helped found the First Unitarian Church of Philadelphia in 1796. That congregation has the distinction of being the first church in this country with Unitarian as part of its official name. So though not certainly not as famous as Priestley, Life was equally unsettled for John Murray in mid-18th century England. Murray's family had converted from Anglicanism to Methodism when he was a child. He grew up a leader of the Methodist boys' group, so not surprisingly, he became a leader of the Methodist community in London as an adult. Now, his faith was challenged when he was asked to make a visit to a woman from his church who had recently converted to Universalism. Instead of helping her to come around, she set his mind and heart on a path away from the faith of his youth and toward the Universalism, which was being espoused by Reverend James Raleigh, who argued that there had been a mysterious union between Jesus and humankind that assured salvation of everyone, and by doing so, was undermining the Calvinist notion of the elect. Not long after he began to explore his burgeoning Universalist faith, Murray's faith would be severely tested. Both his child and his wife would die in short succession. Unable to work and meet his obligations, he was beset by economic difficulties and was sentenced to debtor's prison. Having served his sentence, a heartbroken Murray decided to make a new life for himself in America. And in July of 1770, he set sail, landing first in Philadelphia, but with the final destination in mind being New York City. So at or around this time that Murray is getting out of debtor's prison and beginning to think about and then making his way to America, Thomas Potter is living in what is now New Jersey, and he builds his own meeting house, his own church. He was desperate for theological company and believed that somewhere out in the universe, there was a preacher who shared his radical view that every human being born was saved by a loving God. Potter was alone and isolated in his community because of his beliefs, and yet he persisted. He built his meeting house, and yet for a time, no one came. No one came until the boat that Murray was on, the one that was going between Philadelphia and New York City, literally ran aground at Potter's doorstep. Now imagine that. Potter is literally walking the beach, asking his God why he's alone in his theology. And then there's this ship. Somehow in this gathering of people from the neighborhood or the town in the ship, Potter and Murray meet and have the courage to tentatively share their beliefs with each other. Of course, Potter was convinced that Murray had been sent by God to preach his universal message at his church. But Murray, having vowed never to preach again, wasn't so convinced. Kind of a UU thing. I'm not really sure about this thing that's so obvious in front of me. So they struck a deal. If the winds did not change and the ship remained stuck, then it was a sign from God that Murray was to preach. If the winds did change, Murray would go, and Potter would go back to waiting and walking the beach, waiting for the next ship. 2 days later, on Sunday morning, the ship was still stuck, and Murray preached the first Universalist sermon in America in Thomas Potter's church on September 30th, 1770. For the next several years, Murray and the great tradition of American Universalism was an itinerant preacher. By 1772, he had made his way north to southern New England, and by 1773 was preaching in Boston, where his message wasn't altogether welcome. During one service in Boston, a theological protester hurled a rock through a window where it landed close to where Murray was preaching. Without missing a beat, Murray picked up the rock and, using it as a metaphor for the orthodoxy of his time, said, quote, "This argument is solid and it is weighty, but it is neither reasonable nor convincing." Yeah, pretty cool moment, right? Murray had found his voice, and he had found his deep faith. That same year, he moved to Gloucester, where in 1779, he established the first Universalist church in the United States, which, like the first Unitarian church in Philadelphia, is still gathered and still meeting as now a UU congregation. There's just so much. But importantly, Gloucester is where he also met his second wife, Judith Sargent Stevens. Sargent Stevens was an early and important advocate for the equality of women and also a gifted writer. Her most famous essay on the equality of the sexes was published in 1770. Let's hear that again. Her most famous essay on the entitled On the Equality of the Sexes was published in 1790. She is also credited with helping to edit, if not write, some of her husband's sermons. Murray left Gloucester in 1773 and became the minister of the first Universalist Church in Boston until his death in 1815. Now, Hosiah Ballou was the 11th child born to a Baptist preacher and a farmer in New Hampshire in 1771, and he would go on to become the intellectual and personal leader of American Universalism in the 19th century. With little education and yet many doubts, Ballou began a personal theological search after hearing Universalist preacher Caleb Rich. Ballou had gone to hear Rich originally to defend the faith of his father, the Baptist preacher, but found that the more he read the Bible, the more he felt his universalism was affirmed. And by 1817, Ballou was called to be the minister of the Second Universalist Society in Boston, which solidified his position as the acknowledged leader of that movement, which happened just as the denomination was establishing its national identity. By the 1830s, Universalism was the ninth largest denomination in the United States. In 1863, it was the first denomination to ordain a woman to the ministry, Olympia Brown. Now, the strength of numbers of the Universalist Church began to wane after the Civil War. That was a really important time because, in large part, the utter devastation of that war. It took something as universally horrific to soften the country's religious understanding of the concept of universal salvation, and in doing so, made universalism less unique. The result was a slow but steady decline in membership over the next almost 100 years until the merger with the Unitarians in the mid-20th century. Yet during that time, Universalists, like their Unitarian counterparts, were on the forefront of many of the great social justice fights of the time. Their numbers were small, but their voices were mighty. So the Universalists had their Ballou, and the Unitarians had their Channing. Born in Newport, Rhode Island, his father a lawyer and his mother the daughter of the signer of the Declaration of Independence, Channing beginnings in life stand in stark contrast to Ballou's. The difference in social standing and formal education between the two of those, the leader of the Universalist Church and Channing, who had become on to the leader of the American Unitarianism, is a tangible example of the differences between American Unitarianism and American Universalism. Early Universalist ministers were by and large itinerant country preachers with little or no formal education, while early Unitarian ministers were almost all Harvard-trained. Universalists were unabashedly evangelical. They worked actively to spread their message west, and by west I mean further beyond Worcester. With the exception of the Iowa Sisterhood and a handful of others, Unitarians were more than happy to stay close to Boston. throughout their individual histories and up until the merger of the two movements in 1961, it wasn't theology that separated the two, but economic and social status. And I think that we are still feeling the effects of that, to be talked about later. So William Ellery Channing graduated from Harvard and was called to the Federalist Church in Boston in 1803, where he would serve until his death in 1842. Early in his ministry, he tried to avoid leadership roles, especially in what was emerging as the Unitarian controversy in Massachusetts in 1805. That's when more conservative clergy became unwilling to exchange pulpits or participate in ordination services with those that they considered more liberal. Up until the resolve of the controversy in the early 1830s, each town in our Commonwealth was required to fund a church and pay the minister's salary. There was one way to worship and one set of clergy to guide you along the way. Yet at the beginning of the 19th century, there started to be a split in and among the clergy, mainly based around the understanding of the Trinity and the Calvinist notion of the elect. Until 1819, the term Unitarian was used by the more conservative clergy as a pejorative to describe the liberals and their unorthodox beliefs about God and humanity. That year, Channing assumed leadership of the liberal clergy when he delivered the sermon at the ordination of Gerard Sparks in Baltimore. Channing's sermon, intentionally entitled Unitarian Christianity, intentionally as a way to take back the name, has come to be known as the first denominational manifesto, as it provided a structured platform for the liberal Christianity of American Unitarianism. In that sermon, Channing presented the Unitarian position on the unity of God, the unity of Jesus, and above all else, the use of reason in the interpretation of the Bible. That was the moment when the liberal clergy proudly claimed the name Unitarian. So now we have a name. We just needed a structure. So a year later, in February of 1820, a trial began in Dedham that challenged the notion of one church, one town, one minister, one theology. The local Dedham congregation, like many other churches within the standing order, at least in the eastern part of the state, was facing an internal conflict over theology. The town of Dedham as a whole had voted to call a liberal, Unitarian-identified minister. Yet the actual congregation voted 1750 against the liberal clergyman. So the town voted for them, the congregation voted against them. Because of the confusion surrounding the split between the town vote and the congregation vote, the 17 members of the congregation who voted against the liberal clergy promptly took their communion set, their trust deeds, their securities, and withdrew from the congregation in protest. The remaining 15 members of the church, with the support of the majority of the town voters, immediately elected their own deacons and sued for the return of the property. And the court ruled in favor of those who remained, and it is some indication that the judge was, in fact, a Unitarian. So that even though they were a minority of the congregation, they should have the rights to the name and to the property and to the history of the congregation. And every church in the Commonwealth was affected by this decision. In the aftermath, the divide between liberal and Orthodox congregations was fully exposed, and churches began splitting all over the Commonwealth. In the eastern half of the state, close to Harvard Divinity School and its influence, most of the original churches were Unitarian. In the western half of the state, with the more conservative Yale Divinity School just down the Connecticut River, most original congregations stayed within what we now call Congregationalism, which is why in almost every town in the greater Boston area, the church known as the First Parish or First Church Unitarian is directly across the street from Second Congregation, Congregational Church. So with the growing number of congregation and memberships in 1825, Channing and a group of other liberal clergy began the American Unitarian Association. And as you can tell, after jumping all over the place, this is where we're going to end for now. Because I could keep going and you guys would be polite and stay. But there are so many stories left to tell. Stories of people who live their faith as an everyday ethic. Stories of struggle and identity as a movement. And we will get to those stories going forward, because knowing who we are and from whence we have come is important. Like how it is we went from being two very liberal Christian denominations to a non-dogmatic, non-creedal faith. That is an interesting story for another time. But our Unitarian Universalist story is brave enough to make you proud, tragic enough to make you cry, and yes, at times so inept to make you shake your head once the anger passes. Our history is long in the making. It is a history that is complex and layered, and ours is a faith that some have lived quietly as an everyday ethic, while others have given all they had and more in its defense. It is a history that we all should be proud to know and share. May it always be so. Please rise and